Today's church has lost its sense of God's greatness. Not by replacing the true God with other gods, but by replacing a biblical view of God with flawed and false views. I want to urge us all to hold fast that God alone is great.
Welcome to The Word Unleashed with Tom Pennington. Tom is pastor teacher at Countryside Bible Church in Southlake, Texas. Hello, I'm Bill Wright. Today we continue in Tom's series titled Hold Fast. In Psalm 50:21, God reminds the human reader, "You thought that I was just like you." Sadly, many professing Christians believe that God is just like us. Therefore, many have misunderstood or even missed altogether the truth that God alone is great. As a result, we as Christians must recapture an understanding and embracing of God's greatness. But how do you do that without going down a non-biblical path? As Tom will show us today, you do so by searching the Scriptures to develop the biblical and thus accurate and full view of God. Friend, do you have a biblical understanding of all who God is? Consider the question carefully as Tom Pennington begins today's study now, here on The Word Unleashed.
I want us to continue with a new theme, a theme that remarkably has been forgotten in the church. The year was 1715. It was the year that King Louis XIV died. He had reigned over France for 72 years, longer than any other European monarch had, and he was a magnificent monarch. It was Louis XIV who made the famous and audacious claim, "I am the state." He had a magnificent palace. His court, the Palace of Versailles, was the most magnificent in all of Europe. He even referred to himself as Louis the Great. His funeral, therefore, was designed by him to be spectacular. His body was placed in a golden coffin. It was laid in state in Notre Dame Cathedral. He had demanded that all of the rest of the candles in the great cathedral be snuffed out and that there be a lone, solitary candle placed on the top of his coffin to signify his greatness. Thousands attended the service there at the great cathedral, and they sat there in stunned and hushed silence as their monarch of 72 years had died. Louis had asked Massillon, the court preacher, to deliver the funeral sermon. And that day, as Massillon entered the pulpit, he first paused and very slowly, very deliberately, reached down and he snuffed out that lone solitary candle. He walked into the pulpit and the first words that he said twice in French were these: "Only God is great. Only God is great." That truth is foundational to the Christian faith. It is foundational to the Scripture. God's people have understood it in profound and rich ways in the past, but sadly, it has been lost in our day just as it was lost in His. We began a series entitled Hold Fast, the Forgotten Truths We Must Always Remember. As I mentioned, I borrowed that title, Hold Fast, from William Tyndale's English translation of the New Testament. In five passages in the New Testament, he translates with the words, hold fast. Eventually, sailors adopted Tyndale's words, hold fast, to refer to holding on to the ship's ropes, especially to the lifelines when the ship was being driven by the wind and waves and there was risk of their being swept overboard. In the same way, there are lifelines in the Christian faith, truths that today's church has forgotten, but to which we must always hold fast.
Last time,
we looked at the truth that the Bible is enough. Today, I want to urge us all to hold fast to the forgotten truth that God alone is great. Tragically, today's church has lost its sense of God's greatness. Not by replacing the true God with other gods, but by replacing a biblical view of God with flawed and false views of God. It's like the psalmist said in Psalm 50, verse 21, in the words of God Himself speaking to us, "You thought that I was just like you." There is a wonderful description of our times. You thought I was just like you. Luther encountered this same problem in one of his letters to Erasmus, the great scholar of that period, a defender of the Roman Catholic faith. Luther wrote to him and said, "Your thoughts of God are too human." If that was true in Erasmus' day, and it certainly was, then how much more true is it of our day? Your thoughts of God are just too human. I think we can all be influenced by this. And in fact, I think this sort of human thinking of God pervades the mindset of the contemporary church. Let me give you some common misconceptions of God. Misconceptions that are common in society at large and equally common in the church. First of all, there is the disengaged inventor. There are those who see God as one who created everything, but he's just too distracted with really important things, and so he pays very little attention to us. A second misconception, and unfortunately you hear it even from the lips of those who claim to be fearers of God, the man upstairs. This portrays God as simply the greater, more powerful man who lives upstairs by virtue of his superiority. It conjures up the image of the one who was the bigger and more powerful man who lived upstairs in the estate home while we, the servants, lived downstairs. A third flawed view of God that's very common is the hard schoolmaster. God is simply an unfeeling, heartless schoolmaster who demands that we learn our lessons with absolutely no concern for us as people. Another misconception is the perception of God as the overeager policeman, always watching for us when we cross the line so that he can just let us have it. There's the clueless dad conception of God. He loves us unconditionally, and unwisely he trusts us, and so we are bright enough to sneak around, to pull the wool over his eyes, and to get away with whatever we want. There's the indulgent grandfather. He knows about our sin, but he overlooks it, and he spoils us with whatever we want because he loves us so much. There's the frustrated benefactor. He means well. He wants to do good to people, but our wills are more powerful than his, and so his well-meaning and well-intentioned plans for us are often frustrated. He just can't accomplish what he wants to accomplish. Number eight, and this is, I think, one of the most common views of the church today. It's of God as the good-natured buddy. The one who just sort of hangs around and supports us in whatever we want. He builds his life around ours. And therefore, all of the sermons you hear in most churches are about people, never about God. Always about us and our problems and our relationships and our sex lives or whatever the theme of the month might be at the local megachurch. A.W. Pink writes this: "The God of this century," and he was speaking obviously of the last century, "the God of this century no more resembles the sovereign of Holy Writ than does the dim flickering of a candle the glory of the midday sun. The God who is talked about in the average pulpit, spoken of in the ordinary Sunday school class, mentioned in much of the religious literature of the day, and preached in most of the so-called Bible conferences, is a figment of human imagination, an invention of maudlin sentimentality. The heathen outside the pale of Christendom form gods of wood and stone, while millions of heathen inside Christendom manufacture a god out of their carnal minds. In reality, they are but atheists, for there is no other possible alternative between an absolutely supreme God and no God at all. A God whose will is resisted, whose designs are frustrated, whose purpose is checkmated, possesses no title to deity, and far from being a fit object of worship, merits nothing but our contempt. End quote. The church, as A.W. Pink wrote, has lost its sense of God's greatness. It no longer has a high view of God. It no longer has a sense of the majesty of God. Another way to say it is that the church is no longer captivated by the transcendence of God. When we say God is transcendent, we mean that He is exalted above and beyond us, that He is magnificent, extraordinary, unparalleled, unrivaled, unequaled, unsurpassed, incomparable, unique, superior, supreme, foremost, above all, second to none. Is that how you really think of God? You know, we find comfort in the fact that God is immanent. That's the opposite of transcendent. In other words, that God is accessible to us, that He's our Father, that He's our Abba. But we must at the same time never lose sight of the fact, as the church has, that He is exalted far above us, that God is separate from and superior to everything in the universe. God alone is great. His person, His nature, His deeds are all unrivaled, unparalleled, incomparable. Listen to Jeremiah 10, verses 6 and 7. Jeremiah writes, "There is none like You, O Yahweh. You are great, and great is Your name in might. Who would not fear You, O King of the nations? Indeed, it is Your due." David, in his prayer in 1 Chronicles 29, verses 11 through 13, says this, "Yours, O Yahweh, is the greatness and the power and the glory and the victory and the majesty, indeed everything that is in the heavens and the earth. Yours is the dominion, O God, and You exalt Yourself as head over all. Both riches and honor come from You, and You rule over all. And in Your hand is power and might, and it lies in Your hand to make great and to strengthen everyone. Now, therefore, our God, we thank You and praise Your glorious name." Now let's be honest with ourselves. When you hear me say that God is great, it just doesn't have the impact that it ought to have. It doesn't in my own heart. Why? Well, in part, I think, it's because of how our language has been so misused and over-dramatized. I mean, after all, every text message calls for multiple exclamation points. And how can we begin to comprehend that God is great when advertisers tell us that Frosted Flakes are great? The only way that we can overcome our flawed conceptions of God and our pedestrian understanding of what is great is to let the Bible explain to us what it means when it says that God is great. Nowhere in Scripture is the greatness of our God more powerfully and beautifully explained than it is where I want you to turn, Isaiah chapter 40. Isaiah chapter 40. I want us to look at verses that begin in verse 12 of Isaiah 40 and run down to verse 26. I know you're shocked that we're going to cover so many verses, but we're going to do it. Isaiah 40, verses 12 to 26, makes one central point, and it is this, that Yahweh alone, the God of the Bible, the God who has revealed himself to us on the pages of Scripture and then in and through his Son, that he alone is great and is therefore worthy of your trust. But that invites the question, what is great? How do you define, how do you measure greatness? Well, here Isaiah explains to us what it means that God is great. Isaiah makes four declarations about our God that outline for us his greatness. First of all, he tells us that Yahweh alone is creator. Verses 12 to 14. Notice verse 12. He, this God who's described in the first 11 verses of this chapter as Yahweh, you see the word Lord in all caps, that's the one who simply is. He says, I am. We say he is. That's Yahweh. This God has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, has marked off the heavens by the span, and calculated the dust of the earth by the measure, and weighed the mountains in a balance and the hills in a pair of scales. Isaiah's point is that Yahweh alone created everything. He poetically describes all of the earth. Notice the waters, verse 12, the dust of the earth, the mountains, the hills. In other words, all of this planet. And then he captures the totality of the rest of the universe in that expression, the heavens, plural. He means all of space, everything that exists beyond this planet. And notice how far God surpasses his creation. God is so majestic, he is so grand, that he can measure all of the oceans of this earth in the palm of his hand. God is so great that he can mark off the universe with the span of his hand. Now, obviously, these are anthropomorphisms. That is, they are ways to help us understand God. God is a spirit, doesn't have a body. These are expressions to help us understand just how immense, how magnificent God is. Isaiah describes God as taking a span. A span was a unit of measurement from the tip of your thumb to the tip of your little finger when your hand was spread. That's a span, roughly 6 inches on a human hand. But here, Isaiah describes God as taking his hand and measuring the universe. Notice as well, don't miss the fact that all of the units of measure in this verse are instruments that we use to measure small things. The palm of your hand, the width of your hand, balances, scales. Isaiah intended to contrast the greatness of God compared to the relative smallness of his creation, both the earth and the universe. God doesn't need great things to measure the planet. He doesn't need great things to measure the universe. He just uses his hand. And by the way, Isaiah says, God didn't need anyone's help or advice or counsel either to create the universe or to run it. Verse 13, who has directed the Spirit of the Lord? Or as his counselor has informed him, who helped God? Who gave him advice in creation? Verse 14, with whom did he consult, and who gave him understanding? God didn't need consultants. He didn't need a committee. And who taught him the path of justice, that is, the right, the path of what is right, and taught him knowledge and informed him of the way of understanding? In both of these verses, Isaiah intends to point out the unrivaled, unparalleled, underived, unlearned wisdom of God. He just knows. And he is perfectly wise. He never makes a mistake. He never drops the ball. He never needs somebody else to help. He just knows. Yahweh alone is the all-wise creator, and that helps us see that He is great. Secondly, Isaiah tells us that Yahweh alone is incomparable. Yahweh alone is incomparable. We could say immense. I think that's the idea here in verses 15 to 17. Yahweh alone is incomparable. Now, notice that Isaiah transitions from the cosmos, from the planet and the universe, to the inhabitants of earth and to human history. And notice he begins with two powerful word pictures to show us just how inconsequential human beings are when they are compared to the grandeur, to the greatness, to the majesty of God. Verse 15, "Behold the nations." That describes man in his collective united strength. "Behold, the nations are like a drop from a bucket and are regarded as a speck of dust on the scales." By the way, make sure you understand, God is not here talking about the value of people to Himself. God considered human beings valuable enough that He sacrificed His own Son to redeem us. So He's not talking about the value of people. He's talking about their greatness compared to His greatness. And He says, "Behold, the nations," that is, mankind in his collective, united grandeur, compared with the Creator, is like an inconsequential drop of water that falls from a full bucket as it's being pulled from the well. It doesn't matter one bit. It's not even worth notice. Compare the grandeur and the glory and the greatness of every human being on the planet to God, and it's like that solitary drop of water that falls from a full bucket. It's completely inconsequential. The second word picture he uses is the nations are regarded as a speck of dust on the scales. In other words, humanity, organized, united, perhaps here against God, has no more weight than dust on the scales, which doesn't cause it to tip one bit. They weigh nothing. They're nothing compared to the greatness of God. In fact, verse 15 goes on to say, "Behold, he lifts up the islands like fine dust." To God, the massive coastlands, the islands of the sea, are as easy to weigh as that fine dust that doesn't cause the scales to tip. No effort whatsoever. Now, what Isaiah does next is surprising. Notice verse 16. He says, "Even Lebanon," the country of Lebanon, "is not enough to burn, nor its beasts enough for a burnt offering." He here moves from man's futile attempts to organize politically against their Creator to man's futile attempts to adequately worship their Creator in their own strength. What Isaiah says is there is no religious act that we can perform that is adequate for the worship of the God who exists. If we could somehow make the entire country of Lebanon our altar, and if we could burn all of its famous cedars, and on the altar of the country of Lebanon we could offer all of its animals, it wouldn't be enough. Alec Motyer, who writes a commentary on Isaiah, says this: "Nothing we can do puts God in our debt or at our disposal. This is the death knell to all do-it-yourself systems of salvation. Over every human effort to move God, to meet His demands, satisfy His requirements, maneuver Him to our advantage, and climb into His favor, Isaiah simply writes, not enough. Not enough."
That's Tom Pennington here on The Word Unleashed with part 3 of his series, Hold Fast. Tom will have part 4 for you next time, and we hope you'll join us then. Is your view of the Bible the same as held by Christ? Tom Pennington, in his book, Jesus' High View of Scripture, takes a close-up look at Christ's most famous sermon, the Sermon on the Mount, and shows why every true believer will hold and cherish Scripture with the same approach as Jesus did. If you're a follower of Christ, what Jesus believed about Scripture should shape your own faith and practice as well. Purchase your copy of Tom's book, Jesus' High View of Scripture, today at thewordunleashed.org. And remember to connect with us on social at The Word Unleashed. The Word Unleashed is made possible because of the prayers and financial gifts of individuals like you. Please consider partnering with us. You can find out how to do so by visiting us online at The Word Unleashed. And now for Tom Pennington and the entire team, I'm Bill Wright. Thanks for listening to The Word Unleashed, exalting God's glory, explaining God's truth.